Tonight on Arena, new albums from The Strokes, Lara Marling and Melodion up for review. And Albert Camus' novel The Plague is back on the bestsellers list. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, as it's Good Friday, we thought this was a suitable moment for us to look at the image of Christ in art through the ages, and in particular, representations of the crucifixion. In the process, we'll find out more about the times and the artists who chose the crucifixion as subject matter. Joining me for this discussion are art historians Sarah Wilson and Jessica Fahey, who have picked examples, painted and sculpted images of Jesus from the first such depictions right through to modern times. Jess, first of all, I suppose the crucifixion is obviously a very important moment and a very has huge significance in terms of the Christian religion. How important or how useful a moment is it in terms of the study of the history of art?
It's absolutely vital, actually, in terms of the study of the history of Western art, certainly, given that we can learn so much about the climate that individuals' works were produced within, and we also can understand sort of interesting ideas behind different philosophies or different economic situations within those places, as well as looking at individual artists and their styles. So by looking at different depictions of the same subject over a couple of thousand years, we can trace all of those things that are vital for understanding art history.
And I know both yourself and Sarah are going to give us examples from all sorts of media of the depiction of the crucifixion, but I'll start with you, Sarah, and one I wasn't expecting to get to, as in fact the very first depiction of the crucifixion of Christ, a piece of graffiti.
It is, yes. The really interesting thing about crucifixion imagery is that we don't actually find it in very early Christian art. That's about the 4th century AD. That's one of the reasons for that was because crucifixion was seen as something mental and physically desecrating. It was considered a dishonor and an insult because it was the method that you used to execute common criminals and slaves. So therefore, during the early centuries of the Christian church, that sense of shame remained. And that sense of shame is really demonstrated by one of the very first crucifixion scenes, which, as you say, is a piece of Roman graffiti from about the 2nd century, about 200 AD. And it depicts a young man worshipping a crucified donkey, and beneath it is written the phrase Alexamenos is worshipping his god. So it's basically someone having a go at a man called Alexamenos for being a Christian, and this has been scratched into the plaster wall of a house on the Palatine Hill in Rome.
When then did the attitude change? When did the idea of shame disappear and representations become something else?
It begins again about the second half, the later half of the 4th century AD. Two major events contribute to the reimagining of the crucifixion as this victorious motif. And when I say victorious motif, what I'm describing is Christ's victory over death. So what happened was Constantine the Great, everyone often knows him as one of the very first Christian emperors. He banned crucifixion as an execution method. And then in addition, his mother, the Empress Helena, she supposedly discovered the true cross in the Holy Land. And that led to Golgotha becoming a place of pilgrimage and the crucifixion starting to mean something specifically to Christians and Christians' belief. And we see an example of this in an iconographical type known as the Anastasis or the Resurrection. We frequently see it used on sarcophagi. And what Anastasis iconography shows us is the key row, which is also the monogram of Christ, positioned within a laurel wreath. And then you have two doves picking at the fruit of the laurel wreath, which sits on top of a cross. And then at the very base of the cross, you have two soldiers that are crouched down in this defeated manner. And the laurel wreath, we know, is already associated with imperial triumph. The doves, of course, represent the Holy Spirit. And then those two soldiers refer to the two soldiers who were guarding the tomb of Christ during the Easter victory. And what's really interesting is that later on, we see them in the very early Anastasis sarcophagi, we see them crouch down in this defeated manner. But later on, they're going to rise up and are going to be shown standing on either side of the cross as kind of like a guard of honour. And that's indicative of the spread of Christianity throughout the Roman Empire as the emperors begin to become Christian with more frequency.
Moving on a little bit further up chronologically, in fact, Jess, we come to medieval times and Pope Gregory the Great particularly gets involved in the depiction of Christ. What was his attitude to things regarding these depictions?
Well, he very famously spoke on the value of art for religious practices and saw art as the Bible for the illiterate. And this is essential, you know, to think about in relation to worries of, sort of idolatry or using or appreciating icons in a way not in line with religious belief. But he saw it actually as a very valuable practice, which again, we later, much later in the time of the Counter-Reformation, see that as an influence on them. But in terms of Pope Gregory, the idea for the Bible for the illiterate means that essentially these images have to be easy to read. So they tend to be quite stylized, quite simplified, and are almost working more as symbols rather than as any sort of, clear example of emotional qualities or anything like that we see a little bit later. So the medieval period, if you think, say, of the Book of Kells or sort of stylized illuminated manuscripts, you'll get a good sense of what I mean by that.
And in fact, you can give us an Irish connection into one of these books named after St. Gall's Abbey in Switzerland. But we're talking about Companions of St. Columban.
Absolutely. So the missionaries from Ireland that went to continental Europe brought with them either the books fully completed or brought with them the skills to create them. We're not sure with the Gospel Book of St. Gall whether it was created in Ireland, or whether it was created in Switzerland, where it has ended up. And it's a wonderful example of this very stylized form, whereby the sense of the human form is very flattened. Instead of using any shading or graduation of tone to create the sense of three dimensions, it's just simply line. And quite often, there's no real sense of a real body. Again, highly stylized and very unnaturalistic. But they're wonderful in their directness. And again, following that idea of Bible for the illiterate, that you could understand the subject by looking at this image because it's very straightforward, very direct.
And I think you can stay with me on in terms of the Renaissance, Jess, where we move away from this kind of representative style that we might get in a manuscript into something much more realistic, much more of a sculptural style, I suppose we're talking about, particularly Rogier van der Weyden, a Flemish painter from early to mid 15th century.
Exactly. So essentially what happens in terms of the development of the subject as it's depicted in visual mediums is the influence of, different textbooks and accounts by saints like Saint Bonaventure or Saint Brigid of Sweden, where, and this is sort of 13th to 15th century, where you get a sense of an interest more in the story of the suffering of Christ. And in particular, within that idea that Christ was human and a man, and when he suffered like mankind does. So the depictions of Christ coming up into the sort of late Gothic, early Renaissance tend to emphasise that suffering. And the painting you referred to there, the Descent from the Cross. So just to mention that within the story of the crucifixion, there is the moment of Christ on the cross and then the descent from the cross or the deposition followed by a lamentation or pietà. So they're all sort of within the same moment of the story of Christ. So within the Descent from the Cross by Rogier van der Weyden, one of the reasons why it's considered one of the most influential paintings in the early 15th century is because of the emotive quality, the emotion shown. It's hyper realistic in terms of the details, you know, down to tiny details of buttons and buttonholes and incredible fabrics, as well as now much more realistic looking bodies. But it's the tears on the faces and the clearly heavy dead weight of the body of Christ and the bleeding wounds and these things that are very immediate and direct for the viewer, whereby they can identify the notion of pain and suffering as a way to salvation. And that's a very important development in how these images start to look during the early Renaissance.
And I think another important detail on that painting, Jess, is the state of Mary, the mother of Jesus, in that she is literally fainting, swooning and falling over.
Absolutely.
As the body has been brought down from the cross. Was that a kind of a classic trope of the period?
No, it wasn't actually. There are some earlier examples, but it's actually quite a problematic element because, as will later again be said during the Counter Reformation, that John states that, you know, in the gospel, that Mary stood by the cross, whereas during this much more emotional style of art, this swooning figure is again to tie in with that idea that these mystics, again like St. Bridget of Sweden, would have had, whereby they try to imagine the feelings of a Christ's mother. And they see it through their own personal ideas or understanding of this type of emotion, and the idea then, of course, of her swooning due to grief. And you can trace that sort of development of her as a figure too, as to how she's represented at different periods of art, whether or not she's shown as sort of strong and tranquil or completely sort of overcome with emotion.
And if Grunewald opened up this idea of realism, and I'm using the word gory detail, but I suppose very specific detail around the blood and the physical suffering that was involved, that became even more gory and more detailed and more explicit as time went on.
Yes. So depending on where you are in terms of geographically, you can have examples of extraordinarily gruesome depictions of Christ, both in painting by Matthias Grunewald, as you mentioned, but also in sculptural form, often anonymous sculptors, whereby they've taken the story from the Gospels, and in particular the idea of the flagellation of Christ. So they want to show him with those marks on his body. So he often looks like he's got lots of sort of little red spots across his body. But the distortion of the body in those examples moves a little bit away from naturalism towards almost something that we would consider sort of expressionism, in that the body is crumpled and twisted due to the pain and the suffering. That's style still exists well up into the 19th century, particularly say in South America, for example, where in sculpted forms in particular, they emphasize those wounds and a much more broken body than you would say see in the Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance.
Now you're listening to Friday Night's Arena, and Jessica Fahey and Sarah Wilson are with me this evening discussing depictions of the crucifixion of Christ in art throughout the ages. I'll come back to Michelangelo in a second, because I want to go to Sarah on this one. Tintoretto, Sarah, a Venetian artist. What style are we talking about here?
Well, with Tintoretto, he's really one of the great Venetian painters, and he picks up on some of the trends that Jess was talking about, that idea of emotion and feeling coming into the composition. He was greatly affected by the work of Michelangelo, particularly his sculptural work, and he's known for this very rapid brushwork and muscular figures, and in particular this really strong and very innovative use of perspective. In fact, the energy in his paintings actually earned him the nickname The Furious. And his crucifixion scene is an absolutely monumental canvas. It's about 15 by 40 feet. And it was for one of the confraternities in Venice. So the sort of basically where wealthy citizens could come and join together, essentially. And what he shows us is a panoramic scene of Golgotha, and it's teeming with people. You've got all sorts of individuals, soldiers, executioners, horsemen, apostles, and everyone is engaged with a different activity. There's this wonderful sense of busyness. Everyone has this very energetic sense of urgency. And within this, you'll recognize a lot of familiar narratives. So you'll see two thieves are in the process of being crucified. One of them is being nailed to the cross. This is the impenitent thief. And the other one is about to be raised up. And that is the thief who ultimately does redeem himself. You could also see a vinegar-soaked sponge being offered up to Christ on a stick. You've got a group of men in a little cave gambling for the possessions of Christ. And so above all this activity, above all this kind of urgent activity, you have Christ positioned very high up on a very tall cross, reaching right above all the chaos. And what I find very remarkable, you know, just in contrast to what Jess was saying about the kind of very gruesome images, this figure of Christ is not weak. He's very still, he's very calm, he's very strong, and he almost gives this impression of being an atlas-like figure that's supporting not only the entire weight of the canvas, but the entire weight of the world. And light radiates down from him as he looks down in sympathy at the group of apostles, including his own mother, who is being shown as a swooning figure to emphasize that emotion and that trauma. And they're all huddled together at the base of the cross. And what Tintoretto has done with his composition is incredibly clever, because he has Christ positioned at the apex of a rocky ledge. So it's basically like he's at the top of a triangle. And those strong diagonals really give it a sense of movement and a sense of drama.
I skipped over Michelangelo, but maybe we could touch briefly on. I was quite interested in this case, Jessica, was the idea that, in fact, we think of the Pietà, I think, is probably the most significant image that lots of people would think of around Michelangelo. But that changed from the early part of his career to the latter part, the style and the way he portrayed it.
Absolutely. And within, you know, the space of less than 10 years, we have a crucifix that he created, a sculpted polychrome wood piece for the Church of Santa Maria de Santo Spirito in Florence, which is very sort of sinewy looking figure and nowhere near as beautiful as the depiction in the Pietà in St. Peter's in Rome. And the earlier example, we know that it was given as a gift to the church because Michelangelo had been given permission to go to the hospital to study the cadavers there. So this is one of the other developments in the Renaissance, is that idea of anatomical studies. Yeah. So you move away from the stylized unnaturalistic forms to more and more naturalism. But by the time you get to the Pietà, what you have in addition to that is this notion of the idealized form. So you have to not just look to nature, but you have to surpass it. And in doing so, Michelangelo is essentially being influenced by new philosophical thought, or reintroduced philosophical thought, I should say, particularly Neoplatonic thought. And this idea that the contemplation of pure beauty will bring you to the divine. So the figures become less gruesome and much more idealized. And the figure of Christ in the Pietà, who's draped across his mother's body, while a devastating piece from an emotional point of view, is actually very tranquil, very beautiful, and is meant to contemplate the divine through beauty. And that's really what the High Renaissance brings, and how the image changes during that period.
Sarah, I'll ask you to be brief on this one, because we're going to do the big skip. But there was a big skip in some ways. Not a lot happened in the 19th century. And it's a little bit later on when we get to Emile Nolde. People who may remember the exhibition at the National Gallery a few years back regarding him, and Gauguin. We get a totally different treatment of the crucifixion in this period.
Yes, we do. It becomes a little bit problematic in a lot of ways because, of course, there's a lot of trauma that occurs in the 21st century, specifically World War II. And Nolde was, he was German. He was born into the town called Nolde. His birth name was actually Emil Hensen. And he very much identified quite strongly with German, as a German. In the 1920s, he actually subsequently joined the Nazi Party. So a lot of his work does deal with some of his problematic views, and his crucifixion scene, Martyrdom 1, 2 and 3, it's actually a triptych, is viewed by some people as evidence of his anti-Semitic views. The fact that it's a triptych is quite significant because he's referencing a very traditional altarpiece format, but his central image, which is of the crucifixion, we have Christ in the background, that's the one that's quite tricky because in the foreground you have these two Jewish characters who appear to be celebrating the crucifixion of Christ, and they've been portrayed in a very ugly fashion. Nolde has shown them with these sort of gleeful smiles that reveal these pointed animalistic teeth. Nolde thought this was one way of reading this. Nolde thought that he was depicting his biblical figures as Middle Eastern Jews. He felt that this was an authentic representation of what the crucifixion might have actually been like. However, as we know from some of his letters, as we know from some of his associations, that he did unfortunately hold anti-Semitic views.
I'd have to ask you to be really brief on this one, Jesse. Manny Jellett and Evie Hone, the importance there.
Yes, so Manny Jellett and Evie Hone, two Irish artists who essentially brought abstract art to the Irish public in the early 1920s. And the response to their works was not very positive, called subhuman art, suggested they were suffering from some form of artistic malaria, when in actual fact they were using abstract forms to try convey deep spiritual belief. And to sort of break it down a little bit, the idea within abstract forms was that you could show very universal truths by using universally understood things like pure geometrical shape and pure colour, and that you could actually have an emotional impact from using these colours and shapes as well. And both Evie Hone and Manny Jellett did so in their work, certainly in the 1920s, they're purely abstract, and then later it becomes more figurative. There's great examples by both in the Hugh Lane. Evie Hone, more famous for her stained glass windows, but the idea there essentially is to use modern forms to create a new way of creating spiritual images that are supposed to be more universal ultimately.
And the final word goes to you, Sarah Wilson, on a stained glass window. We're talking about Harry Clarke. Give us a very brief description of his depiction of the crucifixion.
This is an absolutely stunning piece, The Mother of Sorrows, which you'll find in the National Gallery of Ireland. And I think it's a very appropriate one to finish up on, because what we're looking at is a very modern, stylized interpretation of the crucifixion, but it uses a very traditional medieval medium with stained glass. And it's a beautiful cross between a deposition scene and the Pieta. So the Virgin is sitting on the crossbars of the cross, and she holds the Christ's emaciated body in between her knees, and she stares out at the viewer with this incredibly intense, piercing gaze, and that's matched by the intensity of her blue robe. And I think this really is Harry Clarke at his very best, because he's absolutely bathing the viewer in these wonderful blue jewel-like tones with hints of red coming in as well. And it really emulates the intricate skill, colour and ingenuity that you would usually find in medieval Irish metalwork and manuscripts. And here it's been brought into this wonderful modern interpretation. And just one tiny detail, just to very quickly mention. In the background, you'll find very abstract decorative patterns that are actually based on microscopic marine life organisms, so referencing the beginning of life.
All right. And as you say, visible or available to view at the National Gallery of Ireland. That's Jessica Fahey and Sarah Wilson giving us that fascinating discussion of depictions of the crucifixion throughout the ages.
At Electric Ireland, we're here to help 1.2 million homes save on their energy costs by lowering prices from the 1st of April. Every customer will benefit, with up to €100 in annual savings for homes with gas and electricity. That's millions more in pockets across the country. On top of lower prices, our customers will still enjoy a discount rate that doesn't disappear. Find out more about what we're doing for our customers at electricireland.ie, because we're brighter together. Prices valid from 1st of April 2020, subject to change. EAB €1,636, based on average annual consumption, urban 24-hour discounted unit rate, standing charge, PSO levy and carbon tax. Residential dual fuel direct debit and online billing. T's and C's apply. See electricireland.ie/EAB. Savings based on annual consumption.
At Tesco, we're here to lend a helping hand this Easter with delicious dinner options like our Bord Bia approved Tesco finest Irish whole leg of lamb, now half price. There's tasty treats like our Tesco hot cross buns 4-pack for only 49 cents, plus a wide selection of medium Easter eggs like Mars Maltesers and Cadbury cream egg, any 5 for just €5. And get amazing offers on wines like Graham Norton Sauvignon Blanc and Apothic Red, any 6 for €50. Tesco, every little helps. Enjoy alcohol responsibly. Customer quotas apply.
The Plague is a novel by Albert Camus. It was published in 1947 and tells the story of an epidemic sweeping the French-Algerian city of Oran. It's told from the point of view of a doctor who sees early signs that something is desperately wrong. Some 70 years later, our current crisis has sent The Plague back into the bestsellers charts. Mary McGill has been reading it for us and she joins me now on the line from Galway. If there's one thing for sure that this book reminds us, Mary, it's that there's nothing new about pandemics.
Oh, there certainly isn't, Sean. And I tell you, there's actually, I think that's maybe one of the book's greatest strengths. And we know that when Camus was writing it, he took quite a while to write it. It began, I believe, in 1945 or thereabouts, came out in 1947. So he spent quite a bit of time writing it and looking at the history of pandemics and plagues. And he has a couple of lines in the book where he talks about the inevitability of two things: plagues and wars, and how humans are never ready for either of them. So it's a very clever quip, but like so many lines in this book, it just, I felt its echo so profoundly in the present. I'm not at all surprised that it is shooting back up the bestseller list, because there's so much in it that speaks to the present as much as it does to the past.
Camus, of course, one of the, I suppose, the founding fathers of the school of philosophy that we might describe as absurdism. And that's a key theme in the novel, in fact.
Very much, very much. So to say a little bit about absurdism, and thankfully it's a branch of philosophy that you can recognise yourself in very easily if you're a human being. So as human beings, we have certain frameworks for seeing the world. We think about things emotionally, we think about things with reason, and, you know, that can serve us quite well. But what Camus wants us to understand is that reason and emotion and these frameworks that we've developed mean very little to a universe that is fundamentally chaotic, random, irrational. And so when you get the kind of framework that humans use for interpreting the world coming up against this chaotic universe, you get this standoff, you get this tension, and this is absurdism. So, for example, in the novel, we you know, this plague strikes, as you say, Oran, horrible, horrible things happen. And one of them is you know, the really horrific death of a young boy from the plague. And this causes one of the characters, the priest, who had been, you know, giving a sermon about how this plague was sent from God, it was in response to human sinning, all of these things, you know, are very human interpretation of what was happening. And when the priest sees the terrible death of this young boy, as Ryu says to him, he's like, you know, there's no meaning in this. This is random. It's terrible. This is an innocent victim. And so this kind of, you know, prompts the priest to revisit his sermon and so on. So again, this notion of absurdism, it is absurd that a young boy who's entirely innocent would die such a horrific death. And yet here we are in Oran in the 40s, and a plague that people had thought was in the past is now ravaging a community that kind of had been oblivious and thought themselves entirely above something so medieval.
The narrator of the novel is Dr. Bernard Ryu. To what extent can we think of Ryu as being, in some ways, the mouthpiece of Camus? How important is he in the unfolding of the events, Ryu, the doctor?
He is fundamental because he is the narrator. And he is very close to Camus. He's very much Camus' mouthpiece. He is the one who makes these observations, which on one level, you know, drive the story forward. It's a very pacey story. It kind of reads like a thriller. You can, you know, enjoy it on that level. But there's also, and this is what I was really taken with, Camus' distinct philosophical understanding of life and, of course, indeed, of the metaphor of the plague, and it is through, you know, the observations and the experiences of Ryu that we begin to understand the plague is not just about disease, it's actually about the fundamental realities of being a human being. Because we all, Sean, have the plague. And the plague, as Camus sees it, is in relation to the inherent fragility of human life, which we don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about day to day. But the reality is, at any time, our lives, or the lives of the people that we care about, can be ended or upended by events we could never have foreseen. And of course, in the present moment, as in the book with the plague itself, we're being reminded of that fragility in a way that we probably have not been, or many of us have not been, you know, perhaps if ever in our lives, but certainly in a collective sense, historically, not for a very, very long time.
You know, one of the kind of the ways in which the story unfolds in The Plague is there's disbelief, then there's hysteria, then there's a lockdown. Now, we have our lockdown now. Have we avoided some of the hysteria, or what parallels do you see?
Oh, you know, one of the things that the book tells you is to be very, very cautious about assuming generalities with regard to what it is that you think that you're seeing. Because for a long time, as you just said out there, there's kind of like this, on behalf of the citizens of Iran, there's kind of like this bargaining period going on, well, it's probably not going to affect me. I'm going to be okay. I'll just do what I'm told, and so on and so on. But of course, the reality comes from, you know, the death, it's almost like this tide that's creeping up. It begins in certain neighborhoods. People living in other neighborhoods think it's not going to affect me, and so on and so on. But the real test comes when things get very bad and people realize that it's not about their personal being put out, about their plans being cancelled, or their personal dream to escape, or whatever the case may be. The reality is that the only way through this is together. And once people learn to stop thinking of themselves as individuals and put their heads down and volunteer to work with Ryu and to work with the various medical establishments that are set up, it's only then that you really get a sense of coming to terms with what is an absolute catastrophe for this community.
Social responsibility. Now, that's certainly something that we could all sit up and listen to. But, you know, some people listening might think, oh, do I really want to read something about the plague? I want a bit of escapism. But is there something in the novel that you would say is very useful right now for us, Mary?
I would absolutely, absolutely say that there is, John. Like, because you can read this book. It's a brilliant book. I should say, you know, Camus is one of the youngest ever winners of the Nobel Prize for literature. So this guy can write. There's no doubt about that. He's phenomenal. And it works as a thriller. It works as a story about, you know, good and evil and those things battling out. But obviously it speaks to our current moment. And I think in the way that it does that, it does so. It's sober, but it's very wise. You know, Camus says about Oran, the way it was changed, he says, the inhabitants finally freed would never forget the difficult period that made them face the absurdness of their existence and the precariousness of the human condition. And he writes, what's true of all the evils in the world is true of the plague as well. It helps men to rise above themselves. And that's as true in the fictional world of Oran as it is today, I believe. So there's tremendous wisdom, I think, and comfort to be found in this book.
And his daughter, Albert Camus' daughter, Catherine, who's in her 70s now, I believe. What does she have about the novel's newfound popularity?
She is very dismissive of questions about what she'll do with all the new revenue coming from it. She's no interest in that. She's fabulous. She's a very spiky, articulate woman. But she says, Sean, she says, and I quote from her here, she says, perhaps with the lockdown, we will have some time to reflect about what is real, what is important, and become more human. She says, we are not responsible for coronavirus, but we can be responsible in the way we respond to it. And that, in essence, is the message of The Plague, her father's novel.
That's Mary McGill speaking to us about The Plague, the novel by Albert Camus. And so to our final half hour on Friday evening on Arena, time for album reviews, and it's a return to form for The Strokes, New York five-piece that influenced a generation of bands from the Libertines to the Arctic Monkeys. Their latest album is entitled The New Abnormal. Following that, we have Hum, which is the new album from Steve Scullion from Lurgan in County Armagh, who goes under the moniker Melodian. And finally, British folk artist Laura Marling, a Mercury Prize and Grammy nominee, releases her seventh album, Song for Our Daughter. Eamon Sweeney and Zara Hederman have been listening to all three. We'll start with The Strokes. They conquered the world with their debut album, Is This It, in 2001. They're back now with The New Abnormal. And from that album, this is Bad Decisions. Bad Decisions, that's a track there from The Strokes and their new album, The New Abnormal. Zara Hederman and Eamon Sweeney are two reviewers on this Friday evening. I suppose if we talk about The Strokes and 2001, that was a defining moment. I think you mentioned specifically, Eamon, that they changed music totally with that debut album and with what they did back then.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Around that time, you've got to remember, pop was absolute king around the time that album came out in 2001, and Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, who back then was dating Justin Timberlake. That really was the mainstream. The Strokes came along, and I think the interesting statistic about it was up until the Strokes' first album, Technics turntables were outselling guitars, and then the Strokes and subsequently the White Stripes and so on turned that on its head. So I think we forget like how different and amazing that they were. They really kind of were out of the blue. They just sounded like they just kind of fell from outer space, as derivative as they may be.
Well, Zara, I mean, what Eamon's talking about, how they did fall of outer space and seemed like the most exciting thing ever. But things kind of went awry, particularly in more recent times. Was this all about the falling out with Judy and Casablancas? They weren't the best of pals really for a while, were they?
Well, I think what happened there, Sean, was they really did fall to the cliche of, say, the rock and roll of the 70s and the bands of the 70s that they tried to emulate. And they stopped working with the producer, Gordon Raphael, who they worked with on their first three albums. And from there, Julian kind of started to incorporate a lot more of the 80s synth pop style of music that we hear sometimes kind of scattered on this album, but it was very domineering in, say, 2011's Angles, and then on 2013's Come Down Machine. And I think that that kind of riff also in the band comes from how Julian was taking on all of the songwriting responsibilities to the point where all of the songs were credited to him. None of the other members really got a look in. Whereas here, actually, for the first time, we get more of an inclusive nature from the frontman and all the songs, with the exception of Bad Decisions, which listeners might have recognised, a bit of Billy Idol's Dancing With Myself. Everyone kind of gets a bit more of a fair airing on this occasion.
But the song that we just played, Bad Decisions, Eamon, if I played any one of the other nine tracks, would I hear any difference?
Yeah, you will a bit. You're going to hear some seriously cheesy 80s kind of synths in there. You've got Ode to the Mets, which I think is probably the best track. It's like, it's that meets Frank Sinatra, which I know sounds very weird. But one thing to his credit, Julian Casablancas' voice on this record, I think, is really good. I think his lyrics are really good. The tune's just not quite there, but it's so much better than the last two albums, Come Down Machine and Angles, which really were pretty dreadful.
So as a final wrap up then, are you saying, Eamon, that it's good because it's better than the last really bad albums? And how many stars does that mean?
For me, I mean a very solid 3 stars. I think the problem with The Strokes is, to their credit too, the first two albums I think are amazing, stone cold classics. So when you've raised the bar that high earlier in your career, everything else is going to be a slight disappointment. But I think this is a very entertaining, a pleasant disappointment.
All right. So stars, you said 3. What are you saying overall, Zara?
I think that this is a bit disparate. There's a bit more cohesion on this album, but there is a bit too much of the kitchen sink across these 9 songs. So for me, it's going to have to be about a 3 as well.
Around about a three. All right. Don't be too good too soon and don't throw the kitchen sink in, seems to be the advice that both of you would give to the Strokes. Let's move on then to that wonderful word, Balogian. If you know your Patrick Kavanagh poems, you'll know that word. And if you're from up around the border areas, you'll know that word as well, which is exactly where the man who calls himself Balogian comes from. Tell me about Balogian and who he is, Zara.
Yeah, so Balogian is Steve Scullion from Lurgan. He came to prominence back in 2005. He was originally in an indie folk group called Cat Balogian. They were together for 6 years. During the recording of their third album, they actually disbanded. But Scullion quickly moved on, keeping the Balogian moniker. He released his debut, The Deer's Cry, in 2013, which was, again, in keeping with some quite minimal indie folk. Throughout his discography, he's had some really impressive collaborations. Back in 2016, he worked with Steve Albini in his Chicago Electrical Audio Studio, and on this occasion he has drafted in Granddaddy's Jason Little, and also we have Teenage Fan Club's Jerry Love and Joey Warrenker. So here we get a bit more of his indie folk arrangements, but they're fleshed out a lot more and very much heavy-handedly by Jason Little.
All right, let's have a listen to the opening track, and the album is called And the Thief Came In.
Seems like nothing's ever gonna come easy. Feel it coming rapidly.
And the Thief Came In, opening track of the opening track of the album Hum from Balogian, and Eamon Sweeney and Zara Hederman are our two reviewers on this Friday evening. Very interesting opening lyric on that track, Eamon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about formaldehyde gas. It's the only album I can think of which kind of opens with something like that, getting deeply chemical, which kind of belies the very kind of soothing, really kind of lush nature of the track. It's got a kind of a lovely Neil Young kind of feel to it. It's a very soothing album, and Steve Scullion, as thinking in this was, because he can't gig at the moment, rather than sit on a record that he's very, very proud of, he'd rather let people hear it. And so he's released it digitally today, a few months kind of ahead of schedule. And, you know, it must be, obviously, it's a very bizarre and frustrating time for on so many levels. But for musicians, for artists who have something ready to go, it's you know, it's one option of doing it, of kind of short-circuiting the kind of pre-release process and just putting it out there for us all to enjoy, because a lot more people have more time in their hands.
Zara, you mentioned earlier on the presence of Jason Little of Granddaddy. Is he too present, in fact? Is there too much of Jason Little and Granddaddy and not enough of Balogian?
I do feel that he is a very dominating force. Balogian's previous output would have had a very similar strand to Granddaddy's style. And what I do find very commendable across this album is that constantly, with various songwriting components, they do strike a balance of, you know, the very soft arrangements with the grungier sound. Lyrically, there's a nice mixture. But here I just found that the distinction between the two voices was not very well defined, and to the point where this almost made me feel like I was listening to a Granddaddy album in its entirety, which is a shame, because Scullion is, you know, a very talented musician. His vocals are really beautiful, and it just would have been nice to have a bit more of him peppered a bit more throughout it.
Let's have a listen to the title track, which is simply called Hum. There we go. The song is called Hum for obvious reasons. As you can hear, there are no lyrics, although later on, towards the end of the track, it's about 3 or 4 minutes long, towards the end we hear his daughter playing in the background, and then that becomes part of the soundscape. That kind of struck me, Zara, that there's the sound that you might like as a soothing sound during lockdown that this album could provide you with.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, just listening to it there, I kind of got a bit lost looking outside the window and at the trees, and I had to remind myself to tune back in. But no, it is like moments like that, the softer, more spacious arrangements where it's just Scullion, you know, tinkering away at his guitar in his house. It makes it feel very like a very intimate record, and I think in there he does really excel. And there are some really beautiful soundscapes throughout, a lot of nice like pedal steel as well, as we heard in the song earlier. So no, it is a really beautiful piece of music.
It starts from you, Zara.
I mostly enjoyed this album, would like to hear a bit more Scullion in his future records, so I'm going to go for another 3 on this one.
Another 3 from you. And Eamon?
I would go 3.5. I think it's a very endearing and very soothing record. Perfect for the times.
Yes, and a great name, Melodian. My favourite word of this week, in fact, on the programme. Let's move on then to our final artist, and very definitely in the folk stable, British folk singer-songwriter Laura Marling. Her current album is called Song for Our Daughter. Another album which was brought out, the release was brought forward as a reaction to the COVID-19 crisis. Let's have a listen to a track to start out with. This is Held Down. There we go. That's Held Down, a track from Laura Marling and her new album, Song for Our Daughter. 2008, alas, I can't believe it's that long from the first album. I just remember it arriving and it was a huge splash on the music scene at the time. But her background, Zara, her parental background as much as anything else, it almost would seem that she was destined for a career in music.
Absolutely, yeah. Her mother was a music teacher and her father owned a recording studio. So I'm sure it was no surprise to them when Laura, at the age of 16, turned around and said, right, I'm off to London now to pursue my career in new folk. And then from there on, you know, she was associated with a lot of kind of acoustic acts. She was with Noah and the Whale briefly. The first iteration of her band actually had members of what would become Mumford & Sons. Her trajectory from there on, I suppose, has always kind of been underpinned by her fascination with exploring female creativity and the woman's position within society. And as the title of this album, Song for Our Daughter, would suggest, that the angle that she's coming at on this occasion is how she would guide her daughter and prepare her for life and all of its nuances. In another kind of way, it's basically Laura looking to say, like, her teenage self, and, you know, reassuring her about, you know, relationships, be them professional, romantic, and kind of saying, look, it's all going to be okay.
And Eamon, I mean, I heard you kind of nodding in agreement about Alas, I Cannot Swim in 2008. This is album number 7. Has she developed hugely since that, or has she just grown slowly and definitely?
I think grown slowly, and I think in this record, in a very interesting kind of way, because she had this record not been released today, and she only announced the release on Monday. The first new music by her would have been a collaboration that came out this week called Cloak of the Night with Ed O'Brien from Radiohead under the name EOB, which is actually really good. And it seems now that this release has suddenly kind of almost kiboshed that and almost relegated it to kind of second fiddle. It's initially, it took me a while to kind of get past going, oh, here we go, another, albeit very good, take on Joni Mitchell. There was this kind of a certain lushness to it, and a certain kind of a poppiness, and a definite kind of a Paul McCartney influence that she's been citing a lot, that I find it really kind of it grew on me more and more with every single listen.
And as the playlist goes on, does the album change? I mean, that's song that we heard is quite close to the top of it's the second track, in fact, on the album, Zara. Does the style that she gives us change as we move along the track listing?
Yeah, absolutely. We kind of have our fun at the start of this album with those very uncharacteristically 70s Laura Canyon poppy numbers. And then towards the kind of middle half, we get very introspective, very pared back arrangements. And she said that this was a conscious effort to be more economical with her arrangements. It's mostly just Laura either at her piano or playing her guitar acoustically, with sometimes the inclusion of really gorgeous and emotive strings, provided by Rob Moose, who in the past has worked with Bon Iver and The National. Sometimes there's a really glimmering, just solid synth line.
Oh, right.
But yet, no, it does take a shift, and here we get a lot more of a somber and earnest
towards
kind
the
of
end.
Marlin.
Yeah. I'll have to ask you finally for your stars, Zara.
I enjoyed kind of the dexterity of this throughout her discography, so I'm going to go for a 3.
3, and from you, Eamon?
I'd go for a 4. I think it's surprisingly good.
It's surprisingly good. 4 is what Laura Marling gets for her album Songs for Our Daughter from Eamon Sweeney. And before that, Eamon and Zara Hedeman speaking about Melodian from Home and the new Abnormal from The Strokes. And that is our lot on this Friday evening. Paula Shields researched. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you on Monday. Oh, yes, we have a special programme for you on Monday. Joy looking back at some programs we did on Bruce Springsteen, on Bjork, and on The Tudor. So do join us for that.